I'm getting married. I'm getting wet. I'm getting married in the morning. Ding dong, the bells are gonna chime. Pull out the stopper, let's have a whopper, but get me to the church on time. I've gotta be there in the morning, spruced up and looking in my prime. Boys, come and kiss me, show how you'll miss me, but get me to the church on time. If I am dancing, roll up the floor. If I am whistling, get me out the door. Ding dong, the bells are gonna chime. Kick up a rumpus, but don't lose your compass. Get me to the church on time. Sha-da-ba-da-ba-ba-ba-ba-wow. I'm getting married in the morning. Get me to the church on time.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, April 14th, 2024. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantiere. Peter is a playwright, journalist, and historian with a number of books. His new book, Brain Teasers for Broadway Geniuses, is now available wherever finer books are sold. Peter also has columns at Masterworks Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Hello, Peter.
Hi.
So, Peter, coming up next week, our friend Rob Schneider, his production company, J2 Spotlight, that we've talked about a number of times on Broadway Radio, is going to have some shows coming up. And they're short-running shows, and so a lot of folks talk about how they missed them because they didn't know about them coming up. But two of them coming up, we have Do-Re-Mi coming up April 19th to the 28th, and we have Lucky Stiff coming up on May 3rd to the 12th. Both of them great shows. And Peter, you're going to be doing a talk back, right?
Yes, I will be doing a talk back this Saturday, April 20th, after Do-Re-Mi. It won't be all about Do-Re-Mi at all. What it's going to be is about what other musicals happened during that year of 1960. That's what I've been assigned to do, and that's what I shall do. But anyway, it's going to be great fun to see Do-Re-Mi, which, by the way, in the 60s, I am telling you, I can't tell you how many houses I went into where I saw in their record collection the original cast albums of My Fair Lady, South Pacific, Gypsy, and Do-Re-Mi. Why Do-Re-Mi? Because that's where they thought that song Do-A-Deer came from. They knew it was from a Broadway show. They'd go into the record stores and they would get the Do-Re-Mi. You know, that has to be it. However, they weren't terribly shortchanged because it's a wonderful score and includes a hit song, Make Someone Happy, which is really what they should have called the show because the show opened 13 months after The Sound of Music. But it was based on a novel, Do-Re-Mi. Novel is too aggrandizing. It's only 88 pages and 23 of them are Hirschfeld's. But anyway, yes, this is the first presentation this year of J2, and they've moved to a new theater. They've moved to the AMT Theater, which is on 45th Street, just up the street from the El Hirschfeld where Moulin Rouge is playing. So if you keep on walking towards 9th Avenue, it won't be long before you find it on that same side of the street. But what we have to remember about Do-Re-Mi is that indeed it had a great reception from the critics at the time. It was a smash hit review situation. It only lasted 400 performances, and one of the reasons has to do with the final song. Now, I'm only saying that the final song was wrong for the original star, Phil Silvers. It is not wrong for the character. Am I being purposely enigmatic? Yes, I am, because I want you to go see Do-Re-Mi. Lucky Stiff. I still remember the first time I ever saw Lucky Stiff, which was in the Dramatists Guild when Lynn Ahrens and Steve Flaherty were just starting out. This was, it was just so wonderful to see Lynn enjoying herself so much, seeing it come to life with a wonderful cast performing it. But this is based on a book, The Man Who Broke the Bank of Monte Carlo, and not a famous novel, I'll grant you, but Lynn was good at finding those obscure shows, novels, wasn't she? Because, of course, My Guy, I think that's what it's called, became Once in This Island, and whoever heard of that book either? We did all hear of Ragtime, but that's another story, literally. So, Lucky Stiff, a sort of a story that was very famous in the 20s, the type of story that was famous in the 20s. as Ethan Morton calls them, legacy with a catch. And here it is that a guy will come into a great deal of money if indeed he wheels around his dead uncle to Monte Carlo, where the dead uncle wants to at least vicariously experience all the thrills of Monte Carlo can give. However, there are a lot of restrictions, and if he doesn't meet those restrictions, well, then all the money will go to a dog hospital and or something like that. And so he has that staring him in the face that he might lose the money if he doesn't adhere to each and every one of the demands that Uncle Anthony made of him. So it's a great fun show. It was even made into a movie, which I'm certainly looking forward to seeing again before I go. But anyway, I'll be doing a talk back that first weekend there, too. So I look forward to seeing your smiling faces in the audience, and I look forward to your smiling from seeing Do Re Mi and Lucky Stiff.
One of our listeners in the chat room, Paul Witte, said he's flying in just to see Do Re Mi. So,
wow, isn't that something?
So if you are far or near, you can get your tickets to see Do Re Mi at J2SpotlightNYC.com. That's the letter J, the number 2, Spotlight, SpotlightNYC.com. We'll have a link to that in the show notes, and maybe you'll see Peter or Paul Witte. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael's a theater reviewer and essayist. He's the founder and editor of CastAlbumReviews.com. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You could see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Hello, Michael.
Hello, hello.
Michael, you know what time it is?
What time is it?
It's time to put on makeup. It's time to dress up right. It's time to raise the curtain on the Muppet Show tonight.
Yes, believe it or not, not till yesterday did I ever see The Muppets Take Manhattan. And I went to see it at the Paris Theater. So it was so wonderful to see it with an audience on the big screen. They're showing classic movies at the Paris lately in several different series. You really should check it out. In fact, later today, I think I'm going to see King Kong, the original. Ah. But yeah, The Muppets Take Manhattan, a friend of mine has been after me for years to see it. It was one of his favorite movies from childhood. And I can certainly see why. It's so delightful. And for me, it was a trip because so much of it is filmed in places where I have spent a lot of time. In fact, right at the beginning, there's a scene where they go to a producer's office. The Muppets go to a producer's office to get him to produce their show. And the building is 1501 Broadway, where the offices of In Theater Magazine had been. So that was one thing. And then there are several scenes in Sardi's, including a cameo by Vincent Sardi, the owner, you know, one of the original owners who was still with us then. That was great to see him. Cameos by Liza, Joan Rivers, James Coco, Dabney Coleman, Brooke Shields, and a major role for Lonnie Price. I had absolutely no idea. And it's a semi musical. I'm sure many of our listeners have seen it. Not a full musical, but very, very delightful and so well done. And I was glad to check that one off my list.
One of my favorite things, USA Today, there was a parody version, like maybe it was the Harvard kids who did it. But anyway, front page, The Muppets Take Manhattan, Kermit's Demands, page 2.
Well, you know, I do go to Sardi's pretty often, and I had noticed that one of the caricatures is Kermit.
Yes,
in like a producer's outfit.
Right.
But
yeah.
I didn't realize that it was a specific reference to this movie until yesterday. So that so now I'll look at that caricature with a whole different appreciation.
So is this art imitating life or life imitating art? You know, that the fact that the three of us have gotten together on Sunday mornings for the last, you know, 15 years or so, are we Statler and Waldorf or Waldorf and Statler? Or
we need another one.
Also with us this morning is Tony Janicki. Tony, welcome. Glad you made it. We had a little stress here this morning getting Tony into our chat room. Good morning to everybody that's visiting with us live in our chat room. So, Peter, you got to see the Broadway production that just opened of The Outsiders. So tell us about this.
Well, you know, it's funny to come down on two words, but I do think Adam Rapp and Justin Levine made a mistake by including these two words in the show. Okay, why? All right, here's a musical about two warring teenage gangs. Each believes his group is right, and things are going to get out of hand, and it's going to lead to death. Okay, so this musical brings to mind a 1957 classic that became a 1961 film that won an Oscar. So if you were writing this script, would you mention the words West Side? But there they are. I mean, I think it's a big mistake to have it in there when the Soch, shot for socials, harassed the Greasers in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And at one point, Bob, the leader of the Soch, makes a reference to the west side of town and east side of town. Now, I will admit that these show up in S.E. Hinton's novel, which really quickly became a classic. And it's really impressive that she wrote it when she was a teenager. But it's very possible that the words West Side show up in this book. I don't recall them showing up in the movie, which I did watch beforehand. I've never read the book. But and it may be the way people in Tulsa, Oklahoma refer to their city, the West Side and East Side. But in a musical that's so close to West Side Story in so many ways, I think they would have been wise to use North Side or South Side or our turf and your turf. But anyway, it's inevitable. You're going to think of West Side Story when you're seeing this show. And unfortunately, you really have to be magnificent to eclipse West Side Story, and the show simply doesn't. And it's much too much to expect. It is well done, but I still have so many problems with the original property. I mean, what parent actually names their children Pony Boy and worse, Soda Pop? I mean, understand, these are not nicknames. Okay, these are...
They're not?
No!
Oh, that's news to me. Wow.
No.
Okay, I believe you.
Or at least in the movie, anyway. I mean, you know, so, I mean, like, when you see West Side Story, you don't think the Diesel mouthpiece and guitar are the real names of these characters. I mean, these are nicknames, you know, so... But, you know, I have so many problems with the actual property. I mean, it's one thing for the Jets and the Sharks, who are both have-nots, to try to protect what they each believes that they should have or should have or whatever. But here we have college-bound kids. It's established that they have Mustangs and they wear Madras. What are they doing picking fights with these kids? I mean, I don't get it at all why the haves are dealing with the have-nots in a pugilistic way. It makes no sense to me whatsoever. I would think they would ignore them. I would think that they would feel that they are above them, that they're not even worthy of looking at them. So that's very, very strange to me, especially it is established that the Soch are the one who are looking for trouble more than the Greasers, who seem to be pretty much minding their own business. And now I will admit that, of course, there is the conflict that Bob, the leader of the Soch, is very upset that Pony Boy is talking to his girlfriend. But that takes about a half hour to get into the show. Up until then, there doesn't seem to be any reason for any conflict. And by the way, I would think that a lot of brains would be afraid of kids who have brawn. You know, that's another issue that comes up for me in this show. So anyway, but this is obviously a minority opinion, because again, this property is so beloved in both in print and on screen. So anyway, it's it's a very different type of high school musical. Everybody's in high school. It's at least it's established in the novel that everybody's in high school. Pony Boy is 14. His best friend Johnny is 16. Dally has made it to 17, but he seems older because he's already done time in prison, which gives him a strange type of respect among the other kids because he survived it. So they're kids, these are kids' concerns in some subsets, but. All right. So how's the music? Pleasant. How's the cast? Fine. It's very sit-throughable. Again, a unit set, of course, to save money. And some nice work with boards. Nice work. So it's effective when it comes down to the presentation. I did like the direction by Dania Taymor. Is she related to Julie? Does anybody know? The choreography was by Rick Kupperman and Jeff Kupperman. That's the way they're billed. I don't know if they're brothers or married. I'm not sure. But but that's fine. And the wonderful thing about the dancing, and it's very tough for a show like this, is just like West Side Story, they don't look silly dancing. You know, because they are tough kids, you know, and they don't look silly. I'll tell you, I don't get the message of this show either because I'm... Somebody does something very heroic and pays a strong price for that. And it seems like the message of the show is if you get involved in something, you're really making a big mistake. It's not going to help you tremendously much. So mind your own business. Because if one character minded his own business and didn't try to do something heroic, he'd have a better fate, but I'm being perfectly ambiguous because there may be people out here there who don't know the property, but so this is not a show for me because of the source material more than anything else, but it is professionally mounted, and we'll see if it. If there's enough of an audience out there who cares about this property to say, oh, I want to see the musical. I mean, I would have thought years ago that Bridges of Madison County was going to run now and forever because I thought, you know, that novel or that movie was so beloved. Mm. Well, here's a beloved novel and movie too, and we'll see what happens to this one.
So Dania Taymor is Julie Taymor's niece.
Is that right?
Uh-huh, and the Kuppermans are brothers.
Mm-hmm. Good to know.
Just to clarify those things, Michael, do you have The Outsiders on your schedule?
Yes.
I have it coming up this week as well, so we'll chat about it next week. The grosses are not great for it right now. It's playing at 100%, but it's playing at 700,000, 700,000, which... You know, takes into account a lot of papering, a lot of press tickets, and getting friends and family in, and investors, and things like that. But that's still pretty low for playing 100%. I mean, the previous tenant in there was Parade, and Parade was pulling down 1.8 million. Over the $1 million mark. I'm looking at this every single week. Every single week, it played over $1 million. Mm. So we'll see what happens with The Outsiders. And Michael and I will talk about it next week.
Yep.
So next up, Michael, you got a much heralded ticket to the off-Broadway sensation, Oh Mary. You're going to talk about two other productions, Teeth and Dead Outlaw. But let's start with Oh Mary. Peter talked about it before. Did you find it as funny as the others?
I did. And it's nice when a show lives up to its hype. Because so often that doesn't happen. As I say, I had a little bit of a knowledge of Cole Escola, who wrote and stars in this play before this, so I expected good stuff, but the response has been just amazing, and the show is completely sold out for its run at the Lucille Lortel. People are talking, of course, when that happens, people always talk about Broadway. I think that might be a huge mistake because it's such a quote-unquote downtown show. As many people have said, it's very, very much in the style of these shows by the late, great Charles Ludlum. And also his successor, the great, but not late, Charles Bush. So I mean, you can absolutely see a through line. I think not in terms of copying those people, but just the general sensibility, very high camp sensibility, very broad comedy, but also some very touching, oddly touching moments in this fantasy about Mary Todd Lincoln, who we are told what she really wanted to be was a cabaret star. I mean, this is the kind of thing where the idea itself is so funny that if you get an idea like that, you're, I would say, maybe halfway there, and then you just have to write it and act it really well. So funny. And it turns out that Mary is very unhappy because her dreams are not being given full shrift, and but she does wind up her husband Lincoln is very, very he's distraught about her and kind of not sure how to handle her because she's really a ball of fire, but they do wind up hiring a teacher or a coach for her, played by James Scully. And he turns out to be John Wilkes Booth, which eventually leads to a very, very fanciful alternative reason for the assassination of Lincoln. So that's the kind of show we're dealing with here. But it's just alternately hilarious. And as I said, in a few moments, really touching a top flight cast. In addition to Cole Escola as Mary Todd Lincoln, you have Bianca Lee as Mary's chaperone, and in another role of Bill. Tony Macht plays Lincoln's assistant, and another role of Kyle. Conrad Riccamora is fantastic as Lincoln. And as I mentioned, James Scully as Booth. But those people are not identified in the program as Booth, Lincoln, etc. It's Mary's husband, Mary's teacher, Mary's husband's assistant, Mary's chaperone. Mary Todd Lincoln is the only person identified by name. I just was thrilled by this show that it was as good as I had heard, because so often that doesn't happen. The audience was enraptured. They were obviously very, very happy to be there for this very hard ticket. Extremely well directed by Sam Pinkleton, by the way. It can be very difficult to get the tone right for a show like this and not make it overbearing. It's very easy to go too far and to go over the top, but they don't do that here. So I will be very interested to see if there is a future life for this show. I wish off-Broadway, commercial off-Broadway existed to the extent that it used to, and it really doesn't anymore. But we do have New World Stages, mm-hmm. where several shows have seemed to, for whatever reasons, be successful there and have long runs off Broadway. Now, usually that happens after they play on Broadway and then go back to off Broadway or go off Broadway for the first time. So this is a different situation in that sense. But I'm hopeful that might happen. Because
Michael, the New York Times has reported this week that O'Mary is transferring to Broadway.
Really?
Yeah.
So I missed that.
It was in the Friday column. It was in the Friday column, and by Michael Paulson, and he talks about a bunch of off-Broadway productions that are going to transfer. Eddie Izzard's Hamlet looks like it's going to transfer.
Wow!
Annie in the Deep Blue Sea and Job they're all look like they're going to transfer.
Oh, Danny is a little surprising because it was a while ago. Well, as I said, it will be interesting to see if it does transfer to Broadway and is a
Lyceum.
Hit. The Lyceum, yeah. I think it will be the first show of that type to be successful on Broadway. Many people had urged Charles Busch to transfer.
Ibsen's Ghost.
Before that, the one about the one about the nun. I can't think of the title right at the moment. okay, I'll have to look it up. But he was adamant that his type of shows would not be successful on Broadway. When he did write a Broadway hit, it was a very different type of show.
Divine Sister.
So, that's interesting. Maybe we'll see, one or both of these other two, off Broadway shows that I recently saw, Teeth and Dead Outlaw. Teeth would be a real long shot because this is a musical about a young woman who has vagina dentata, which means that she has teeth in her vagina. This is apparently based on an urban legend. If they hold up one bloody severed penis in this show, they hold up eight of them. it's like, one isn't enough. I mean, it's very, very over the top and very, very scatological. There are things discussed and mentioned and sung about in this musical that you probably never thought you would ever see in any musical. By the way, Book and Lyrics by Michael R. Jackson, Book and Music by Anna K. Jacobs, directed by Sarah Benson. And this was at Playwrights Horizons and is another really hard ticket. Phenomenal cast with Stephen Pasquale in one respect or another, what might be thought of as the role of his career, because he's so hilarious in it, which is something, an aspect of his talent that I think he'd had very little opportunity to show before. And I actually ran into Stephen at the West Bank Cafe across the street from Playwrights Horizons the night after I saw the show. And I said, you know, I thought to myself that Stephen must be having so much fun with this. And he said, I am. He said, but I'm so tired. I've never had to work this hard in the show. Wow. Usually I just come on and sing a few songs. But here he's on. He plays two different roles and he's on stage a lot. And there's a lot of choreography and musical staging in this show. And a lot of doubling as well, with the characters appearing in various different scenes. So he's great in it. And also Courtney Bassett, Phoenix Best, Will Connolly, who I always love seeing on stage, Jenna Rose Housley, Jared Lofton, Elise Allen Louie, Lexi Rhodes, Ren Rivera, Helen J. Shen. And I did not see Jason Gotye, unfortunately. Again, the show has been running for a while, so he was out, and the part was played by Sean Doherty, who did a phenomenal job. It's interesting to see these shows that seem like the quintessence of off Broadway, and then they're successful and what happens to them. As I said, they used to be able to go to commercial runs off Broadway, but it just, for very complicated reasons, that seldom happens anymore. So we'll see. But the last one that I saw recently off Broadway that I do think could be a wonderful hit on Broadway is Dead Outlaw. Which I saw at the Minetta Lane. This is an Audible production and very small scale, almost semi-staged, you might say, because that's how the Audible shows usually are. But I think it could be quite easily expanded to a fully staged Broadway musical with full sets, et cetera. And the thing about this show that I want to say right at the beginning is that it has the best score that I have heard on or off Broadway in years. Music and lyrics by David Yazbek and Eric De La Pena. Apparently, they both collaborated on both the music and the lyrics, not a situation where one wrote the music and the other wrote the lyrics. Book by Itamar Moses, conceived by David Yazbek, around this incredible but true story of this outlaw who, in the late 1800s or early 1900s, who winds up eventually being killed because he's an outlaw. And believe it or not, his actual body ends up as an attraction in a sideshow in an amusement park. And this is absolutely true. This all happened. And David Yazbek thought this was a very interesting story to write a musical around, and he turned out to be absolutely right. I can't tell you how good the music is. I just loved it on first hearing. It's very accessible, but that doesn't mean it's simplistic. And the lyrics are vastly superior than anything I've heard on Broadway recently. And we'll get into that maybe next week when we talk about some of these other shows. But I hope this has a future life. And again, an incredible cast. Andrew Durand, who did a few shows some years ago, and then it seemed to me like maybe he disappeared. But he came back in Shucked and was amazing in that. And now he's the lead. He is the title role, the dead outlaw in this show. But we also have Jeb Brown, Eddie Cooper, Dashiell Eaves, my neighbor, Olivia Knittel, K-N-I-T-E-L. I hope I'm saying that right. Ken Marks, Trent Saunders, Tom Sesma is in this show. Always love to see him on stage.
Me too.
And also Emily Fink, Austin Koo, George Merrick, and Max Sangerman. So I don't know if you'll get a chance to see this off Broadway, but I do hope something happens with it as in terms of a future life, because I absolutely loved it. And this is going to be I don't go out of my way to get too many new cast albums lately. I usually wind up acquiring them in one way or another, and in many cases I don't even listen to them, but this one is going to be a repeat listen for me. I'm telling you now, I can't wait for that cast album.
Okay, so that is Michael's trio of reviews. We'll have links to O Mary, which is playing at the Lortel through May 12th. So you have about a month there. Teeth at Playwrights Horizons, which was extended through April 28th, so you have about 2 weeks there. And Dead Outlaw at Minetta Lane through April 14th, so today is its last day. So maybe we'll see another incarnation of this. Certainly, it's been very popular, and lots of things at Audible's Minetta Lane Theater are recorded and released at a later point. So,
yes,
see what happens there. So, Peter, you headed over to 57th Street and Carnegie Hall to see Patti LuPone. Tell us, what is Miss Diva up to these days?
Well, you know, Michael mentioned Lonnie Price a little while ago, and Lonnie has worked with Patti on more than one occasion, and he said to me, you know, the wonderful thing about her is that she does treat everybody the same. She will treat the President of the United States the same way she'll treat a waitress, and he means that in a good sense. It's not that she's snarky to everybody. She's nice to everybody. She's and that sort of came through when she made her entrance, because she came out and she did a lot of waving to people in Carnegie Hall, which was packed, just waving here and there. waving to the people on the left side, the center, the right, coming back, waving some more. And I thought it was just a lovely introduction. You really got the impression that she was thrilled to be there, and she was thrilled that we were there. And it was just a very nice way to start it off, as opposed to just coming on and taking a deep bow. Very welcoming, so I really liked that. What I found more interesting than anything else was it reminded me of something that William Goldman wrote in The Season, that Judy Garland was singing her songs at the Palace Theater that season, and everybody's going crazy for the songs. And then she sings What's Now My Love. He doesn't identify it, but I looked at the program and found out that's what it was. and nobody's really responding because it's not a song associated with her. So needless to say, at this night, the Titanic reactions went to Don't Cry For Me, Argentina, and Songs From Anything Goes. And some people was the first one to really, really, really get an enormous burst of applause. But when she did rock songs from yesteryear, sometimes she did whole songs, sometimes she just did snatches of See You in September, which was written by the guy who wrote 1776. And it's Summertime, Summertime, Summertime. The applause was very polite. And that's what we want to hear from Patty, and she still sounds wonderful, and a good time was had by all.
Okay, so that was seems to be a Patti LuPone, A Life in Notes, was a one night only thing at Carnegie Hall. I'm not sure if she's doing it elsewhere.
Oh, she is doing it elsewhere, and has gotten great reception for it.
Okay, so we'll
and
have a link
big
to that.
News yeah. this week that yeah. she will be
oh,
returning
yeah, right,
to
right,
somehow
right.
be returning to Broadway
right.
without an equity card.
Right.
In a play with Mia Farrow.
Yeah.
A two-hander, I believe.
Uh-huh.
Called Roommates, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of people a little bent out of joint about Patty's return to a Broadway stage as she shunned her union membership a few years back and opted out of the union. And so, you know, see what happens and how they work that all out. But
as I said, there may be more drama off stage than on in that play.
Patricia
Elliott says something quite wonderful, I thought, about when two famous people get together and they're doing a two-person show. She said, what happens is they either love each other or hate each other. And she said, but each is a possibility. So even when you hear about people who are just horrific, they have awful reputations. I still remember Patricia Elliott laughing hysterically when I told her who was going to be in a certain production. Said, oh, I want to be backstage for that one. And then said, you know, but, you know, on the other hand, sometimes they really wind up loving each other or choosing to love each other rather than choosing to hate each other. It is a choice.
But to clarify, I wasn't even referring to that. I meant I meant specifically the equity situation.
I see.
Will
leave
they
it to me to muddy it up.
Will equity make it a big deal? Will they pick it? Will they, you know, I mean, so there's all of that on top of all of the controversy about Mia Farrow with Woody Allen.
Mm-hmm.
And so it could be really, really interesting.
It's interesting. Tangentially, the Times had an article last week or the week before about how Woody Allen's newest film has been sort of shunned by a lot of people, that they're not giving Woody Allen the pass anymore.
Right.
So,
Well, the fact that it's in French may have something to do with
it. Yeah. maybe he should do a remake of Father of the Bride.
Oh, boy. that's rough.
Wow. Wow.
So, oh, boy. All right. So, Michael, you got a chance to hear the NYU Broadway Orchestra. So tell us about this.
Oh, what a fantastic evening it was Ted Sperling conducting the NYU Broadway Orchestra, and he spoke at the beginning of the performance. This was at the Skirball Center at NYU, about how we're training the next generation of Broadway musicians. And just, I mean, you could certainly not argue with that, having heard this incredible concert of this 44-piece orchestra, I believe, was the number I counted, on stage at the Skirball, doing just everything you'd want them to do, from the greatest scores ever. Overture from West Side Story. Now, you may say, there is no overture from West Side Story. Mm-hmm. But Bernstein wrote one after the fact, because the show itself became so popular and people wanted to program an overture from West Side Story. So he wrote one, although it was never used in the original production. A sort of adapted version of it was used in the film, the original film, which has a complete overture. So it was somewhat similar to that. Then we had... and this was not just orchestra. It was orchestra and some really amazingly talented young singers. So next we had the entire bench scene from Carousel, If I Loved You, sung by Connor Burns and Anna Miley. And I want to tell you, they were both amazing vocally, but also I have to say it was one of the best acted versions of the bench scene that I've ever seen. And there's so much in that scene for actors who know what they're doing. I think maybe it was partly the fact that they were age appropriate for the roles. But there was a freshness and a spontaneity and just an identification with the characters that seemed absolutely incredible. And one moment I'll never forget is it's a very long scene and song, as we all know. But after Julie Jordan sings her chorus, I guess you would say, of If I Loved You, that beautiful, beautiful song. And then she comes to a stop. And then Billy immediately goes on and says, well, anyway, you don't love me. That's what you said, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. But what he did here, Connor Burns is Billy, he was obviously so moved and so taken aback by what she had just sung to him that he, I mean, you could see it on his face. He had a moment where he really did not know how to respond. And so then he just said the first thing that came to his mind. Well, anyway, you don't love me. That's what you said, wasn't it? It was an unforgettable, incredible moment. Then we had Sidney Hull doing Adelaide's Lament from Guys and Dolls. Stephen Wagner doing Tonight at 8 from She Loves Me. One of the highlights was I had reported on the NYU Steinhardt production of Titanic that I saw only a couple of months ago. Well, they got the two young fellows who played Barrett and McBride back, Joshua Vreeland and Evan Shields, to do the proposal / The Night Was Alive. So I got to see and hear them do that twice within a couple of months, and this time with an orchestra even larger than when I saw Titanic a few months ago. So that was amazing. Then we had, Ted Sperling picked such wonderful music for this concert. One of my absolute favorite moments from Sweeney Todd, which is, I guess, not one of the more famous moments, the quartet Kiss Me / Ladies in Their Sensitivities, which was cut from the movie. And that was one of my major problems with that film. But here we had Evelyn Pham as Joanna, Matthew Frampton as Anthony, Ben Snyder as the Beatle, and Joe Kotze, K-O-T-Z-E, as the judge, doing a phenomenal job with that beautiful, beautiful piece. We had the prologue, Good Morning Baltimore from Hairspray, with Eden Franco as Tracy. Ted gave a nod to jukebox musicals with Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow from Beautiful, the Carole King musical, performed by Lily Parker as Carol as the lead, and then Anna Miley and Stephen Wagner backing her up. Then we had the cleanup spot was Defying Gravity from Wicked. amazingly done by Shea Sullivan as Elphaba and Jordan Fippo as Kalinda. And the finale, rather than taking it easy for the finale was the overture from Candide. An unbelievable, amazing, beautiful afternoon. And it's, as my friend Kevin McInerney, with whom I attended, commented, the orchestra here was, well, it varies, but in some cases, three times the size of what you will hear, or maybe even four times the size of some Broadway orchestras nowadays. So it's sad in a way that we don't get full orchestras on Broadway so often anymore. But thank God for places like this and schools and other venues that do offer us that incredible, unsurpassed experience.
So that was the NYU Broadway Orchestra at the Skirball Center down at NYU with Tent Sperling. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like I can find any more additional performances of
there wouldn't be. Yeah,
but it seems like they do it every spring. They do a NYU Orchestra, Broadway Orchestra thing. I've found them for previous years, but not this year. So check it out. I've been avoiding this the whole morning. I'm so afraid to say this word. So the Ensemble Studio Theater did a production of a show that Peter is going to tell you how to pronounce. See how I got out of that?
I wouldn't count on that, but anyway, I'll do the best I can.
Oh, Michael will correct us. Okay.
Las Borinquenas. Uh-huh.
Ah, yes. That's what I was going to say. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. That's what we were all going to say. We're all going to do the best we could with this. This is a play, a new play by a gentleman named Nelson Diaz Marcano and directed by Rebecca Aparicio, a name known to me from a shortstop in the major leagues from years ago. Mm-hmm. I wonder if there's a relation. And Ensemble Studio Theater is a tiny, tiny space on 52nd Street, very close to the river. It's in an office building, and it's been there for a long, long time, and it's done a lot of good work. And this is almost no exception. This is a very fascinating idea for a play, but it takes it a while to get going, and it points you in a very different direction because it seems to be starts in 1952, and it seems to be about two women who are in love, and it's love that dare not speak its name, and especially in Puerto Rico, and so that's what it seems to be about. Then it's not about that at all. What it really is about the birth control pill and developing it and trying it out on people. And they decide to try it out on these women in Puerto Rico. And there is a great deal of resentment. This is not unlike Miss Evers' Boys, actually. It's a variation on that theme. I get the impression that this really happened. The playwright knows what he's talking about. But the difficulties that some women have in dealing with this pill, it's not approved yet by the FDA or anything like that. So this is really, they need people to try it out. And what's going to happen? There are a lot of pains that women experience, and a lot give up, and some won't give up. And what happens to the women who do give up? I mean, do they get pregnant? Will they have the baby? So on and so forth. A lot of good questions. I just don't really know where the lesbian aspect really helps to support this very much. Unless... yeah, maybe this is based on real people. That could be. I'm not sure. But once it gets going, it's very powerful drama and really, really wonderfully performed by five actresses who really, they're all new to me, but they were quite fine. And so, I don't know, we might, but the word, by the way, actually means Puerto Ricans. That's at least what Google Translate told me, so I will trust it.
Well, and also, Peter, I just discovered, you remember the new film of West Side Story, the scene at the beginning, right after the rumble, where Officer Krupke and Schrank come in and break up the gangs, and then they send the Puerto Ricans away, and they go away singing the Puerto Rican national anthem. That is called La Borinquena, is the official anthem of Puerto Rico.
As Oscar says at Mary Mary, the things I'm learning today. So anyway, a definite play to be reckoned with, but I wouldn't mind one more rewrite.
All right. And that is playing through through April 28th. So you have 2 weeks left to go check it out. And we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Finally, this morning, Peter, you got over to the New York Gilbert and Sullivan Players to see Trial by Jury. So tell us about this.
Well, the thing I want to say about this is that there was a time when the Gilbert and Sullivan Players, the New York Gilbert and Sullivan Players, to be specific, we're a pretty ragtag bunch. It was pretty much community theater, or glorified community theater. And longtime listeners know I love community theater. But nevertheless, there are differences that can be gleaned from time to time. And I have to say that going to see this group in the late 70s, early 80s, it was good to see the operettas. And there was a time when these shows used to get done on Broadway all the time, but those days are long gone. So if you want to see the Mikado or HMS Pinafore, et cetera, et cetera, here's where you go. But Trial by Jury, and paired with The Sorcerer, by the way, which is not a strange pairing, because Trial by Jury is a very short show. It's about an hour. And it really proved that these people have really notched it up. They really had tremendously talented people, beautifully, beautifully sung, wonderfully directed, modest but not cheap scenic design, and really a very delightful experience. And it's always so much fun to be in a GS-centric audience, because, of course, so many people know these things chapter and verse, you know, and they're very, very polite, and they don't sing along, but boy, do they mouth along. And I always, whenever I'm seeing any show, this is true of the 12,700 I've seen, I always turn around and see what the audience is reacting. How, to be perfectly frank, the husband's asleep. The thing is that it was great fun to see a sea of mouths mouthing the words, all of Gilbert's lyrics, which is really quite nice. And so it's a very welcoming crowd. So people, you know, just glad to see each other. They've really been faithful to this organization. It's been around really for a long, 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 long time. And it's just very nice to see how they've accelerated their artistic vision and goals, and have done very, very well by them.
Okay. So I have a link to the New York Gilbert and Sullivan Players website in the show notes, so you can check them out there. So that wraps it up for today. Before we get on to our brain teasers and our musical moments, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to Apple Podcasts for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in Apple Podcasts. There's many ways to get us. You can find us on Patreon, patreon.com/Broadway Radio, to get our broadcasts early, plus special access to all the other things and special shows that we have just on Patreon, and support all the other Broadway Radio shows that are happening as well. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me can be found in the show notes at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So, Peter, do you have an answer to last week's brain teaser?
The Show Me State, the Bluegrass State, and the Land of Lincoln could very well bring to mind a musical theater character. How? Well, I mixed them up a little, because actually the Bluegrass State is Kentucky, the Land of Lincoln is Illinois, and the Show Me State is Missouri. The first letters of those states K-I-M is the name of a character in Showboat, who was actually named for those three states because she was born on the spot where the three states share borders. So Tony Janicki returned to first place, and on his first guess yet. Wow. Followed by Arthur Robinson, Josh Israel, Brigadude, Fred Abramowitz, and Ingrid Gammerman. This week's question. Baby June was established to be 3 foot three. Dainty June was revealed to be 5 foot two. Someone who was mentioned in a song in a Rodgers and Hammerstein hit is between those two in height. Who? What musical?
Okay. If you have an answer for this, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com. We'll let you know if you're on the right track. So, Michael, what do we have in this week's musical moments?
Well, I was privileged once again to see the amazing Marilyn May at 54 Below for her 96th birthday engagement. Mm-hmm. I did not attend on her actual birthday, which was the 10th, but I went on Friday the 12th and was a love fest as always. This show with music director Ted Firth, Tom Hubbard on bass, and Mark McLean on drums was consisted entirely of Broadway songs. Usually when Marilyn does a show, at least half of the songs are from Broadway because, you know, that's when at the height of her popularity, that's the kind of stuff that was still popular. And she made so many recordings with so many wonderful songs. And there were endless highlights for this show, but I would note three songs. She opened with Golden Rainbow, which every time I hear that song, mm-hmm. I think the same thing. Back in 1966, I think it was fair to say that was considered a second or third rate vehicle for Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet. And no one would ever have mentioned it in the same breath as, you know, the great musicals mm-hmm. of the time. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that's still true, but regardless, if you listen to it now, it's so fantastic. You know, what Walter Marx wrote as Stephen, as Peter mentioned quite recently, because Walter Marx was at, what was the thing that he was?
Stephen Eady. Debbie Gravett and David Lawrence.
Yes, yeah, he was present for that right. concert at Zankel Hall, and he's still with us, Walter Marx. But he, mm-hmm. what he wrote, you know, is so perfect for a show set in Las Vegas that starts Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet. But also, I think the songs, even if you take them out of context now, they sound really, really terrific. So that was the opener, and that got things off with a bang. Marilyn sang "On a Clear Day You Can See Forever," which I don't think I have heard her do before. So that was a very special treat just because for that reason. And then she did 50% from Ballroom, and I've heard her do it many times. But as I said to her after the show, I think this may have been the best one of all in terms of the acting. Not to say that all the others weren't amazing, but there were just moments here where it really seemed like she was really creating the illusion of the first time.
Which is why, Michael, I would almost take issue with what you said earlier when you talked about back in the old days, she was at the height of her popularity. She might be at the height of her popularity now.
Well, yeah, I will gladly accept that. I guess it's a different kind of popularity She was on the Johnny Carson show mm-hmm, 76 mm-hmm, times. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, the audience was greater. But yes, mm-hmm. she has a beloved, mm-hmm. very, very loyal mm-hmm. following now. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. Anyway, the 50% was unforgettable. Especially in her performance this evening. And I said, I can't really explain what was so special about it. And she said, well, it, you know, it's just the way I feel it on different nights. So anyway, that was really great. And in tribute to Marilyn, by the way, you have not missed her in this engagement. She has some more dates coming up in early May. So please try to get to see her if you can. And then she'll be back in October in case you can't get there in May. Our two musical moments for today. The opener is another song that she sang the other night, and I was glad to hear her do it live. It's a fabulously up-tempo version of Get Me to the Church on Time from My Fair Lady. And the closer, which she also sang the other night, was Before the Parade Passes By from Hello, Dolly. So these two recordings are from the 60s, but Marilyn May has still got it. And it's astonishing the degree to which her voice is still intact and her interpretive powers. So tribute to her with great love.
All right. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
The cymbals crash and the sparklers light.